to From Believing to Being, a podcast about pursuing meaningful spirituality after faith deconstruction. We're your hosts.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Dave.
We're two former evangelicals having an ongoing conversation about what life and spirituality look like after letting go of our religious beliefs. Join us as we discuss deconstruction, Christianity, mysticism, enlightenment, and consciousness, and most importantly, how to experience this new way of being in the midst of parenting, careers, and going about our everyday lives.
If you've recently left your faith or simply feeling pulled into a deeper way of being, we hope this podcast will encourage and inspire you and really just reassure you that you're not alone on this journey. Welcome back, everybody. We are episode 6. Feels good. We're getting some momentum here and having this ongoing dialogue. So thanks again for tuning in. And we are about a week away now from Christmas. So, you know, like all the TV shows like to do, we figured we would do a Christmas themed episode for our celebration, I guess. So here we are talking about Christmas kind of things, and we'll kind of just see where that goes. But to start us off, yeah, Karen, I wanted to touch on a little bit about, you know, what kind of things we're doing. So what, you know, 6 days away, do you feel ready for Christmas? What kind of stuff do you foresee you and your family doing?
We have a pretty chill week. We're here. We're not traveling. We're just hanging out for Christmas. We don't have anybody coming. My kids get really stressed out about Christmas. They're constantly worried that, and until they see presents under the tree, they don't believe that we have done our shopping. So there's always like, Mom, there's 8 days until Christmas. You need to buy our presents. You need to buy our presents. Like, and you know, I'm trying to be the mom that, like, I always love that image on Christmas Day, whenever you come out and it looks like all the presents under the tree have multiplied.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to do that with my kids, just putting a few presents out at a time. And yeah, so they get all stressed out about it. I put some presents under the tree. I always like hold a few back, of course, but they take them out. My two youngest, my 8-year-old and my 6-year-old, take the presents out from under the tree multiple times a day. All the bows and ribbons are falling off. I don't even know why I bother. I'm just like, great, you know, can you guys please be careful shaking them and everything. So we're done with our school stuff. And this week probably can do a little bit of Christmas shopping, try to go ice skating at our local ice skating rink and, you know, maybe go looking around at Christmas lights and things like that. But we don't bake some cookies. We don't have anything big planned this week, but how about you guys?
Yeah, it sounds fun. Kind of the same, actually. So yeah, if you remember, my kids are, I don't know, roughly 2. I kind of am tired of telling everyone their age in months. So they're a little bit under 2. So we're rounding up here. And so they're not at an age yet where they understand Christmas is coming. But they do understand cookies, and we actually just made some pretty sweet, like, gingerbread white chocolate cookies today, and our kids loved it, and they fought over it a little bit. Anyway, that was fun. And then, yeah, speaking of lights, we did a driving around our local area last night, and we saw the coolest light show. You know those light shows on houses that's like synced up to music? It was unreal. I was like, I think I should be paying for this, because it was so, I was like, I don't know how they do it. There was probably 500 lights or more, I don't know. And it was all just perfectly choreographed, if you use that word with music or lights. But either way, it was really, really good. So we're probably going to try to do more of that this week too, right? Like, yeah, find cool lights. I haven't been into it as much in the past, but for some reason I'm just really drawn to it this year. But yeah, other than that, pretty chill. I mean, we'll do some family time. I'm still working a little bit, but some family time, just my wife and I and the kids. And then I have a brother that lives nearby, and then a brother that lives out of town. They're coming into town, so, and there's all kids, so that'll be kind of fun. We'll see them for a little bit, and we'll have what, five kids under four, I think. So most of them under two, so that'll be an interesting experience. But and probably three dogs, so it'll be a ruckus. And I think we're all getting together like the day after Christmas, so it'll be fun.
Oh, yeah, that will be fun. So I wanted to tell you. So I used to read my kids the Jesus Storybook Bible for Advent. Several years ago, when they were younger, I had, I don't know, somebody online had printed out a list, because obviously there's more than 24 stories in the Jesus Storybook Bible. But someone had made a list of stories to read for each of the days leading up to Christmas. And obviously, I don't do that anymore. And I don't know, I kind of miss having something Christmassy to read to them, aside from just copious picture books over, over the month. One of the groups that I'm in on Facebook for our homeschool told me about this book called How Winston Delivered Christmas.
Oh,
And
nice.
it's an Advent story in 24 and a half chapters. How Winston Delivered Christmas by Alex T. Smith. And the way that it's set up is there's a short little chapter, and then after the chapter, there's a Christmas activity. They have like a gingerbread recipe, or like donate your toys or whatever. And the story is all about how this little mouse finds a Christmas letter and the adventures and obstacles that he goes through to try to get the Christmas letter to Santa. And it is just the most precious story. My kids loved it. I mean, I got it a little bit late, and so we didn't do it every day, but I mean, we read through the book in like 4 days because my kids kept wanting me to keep reading. And it just, if people out there have little kids like you and they're looking for something to do every day as a regular basis to either substitute for the Jesus Storybook Bible or wherever, this is just the sweetest book. And apparently, I don't there apparently there's another Winston book out there. I don't know if it's a Christmas book, but apparently he has another book out there that is similar. It brought a lot of joy. I cried at the end of the book. My kids are like, "Oh my God, Mom, you always cry." But it was just had a really sweet ending, and it was just really fun to read about his adventures. So yeah, How Winston Delivered Christmas. Excellent, excellent book.
Nice.
So
We'll definitely check that out. No, go
are you
ahead.
guys going to be going to church? Going to do any sort of Christmas Eve service or anything?
That is the question.
I just thought about that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, there's the COVID question mark, right? That always like throws a wrench in things. Unfortunately, here we are almost 2 years later. So there's that, but I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Did you guys do that in the past?
Well, definitely, yeah. I mean, we were very like kind of traditional in that respect. Like we had some family traditions around that with like more extended family too. There's a really big mega church up by us that does pretty cool, kind of like a big performance almost for Christmas Eve services that they've been doing. It's a big tradition of theirs. But we're not going to go to that. So we'll see. Odds are probably no.
Yeah.
Especially with our kids our age, they're kind of a big limitation, especially when places don't necessarily have childcare. But what about you?
Just as I asked you that question, I had a feeling of like, I think that this year I could go to a Christmas Eve service, but I probably won't. My most favorite Christmas Eve services are the ones that are at like 11 o'clock at night. And you come, or you come out, and it's midnight on Christmas Day, and people are holding their candles and singing "Silent Night" or "Joy to the World," and ideally it would be snowing, and it would feel very magical, like I'm in a Hallmark movie. That would be my ideal Christmas Eve service. But no, I mean, one, I don't think getting churches around here offer them that late, but also I just. It's probably not going to snow, so why bother?
That's probably not in does it snow much by where you guys are?
We have good years and bad years.
Interesting.
But in the past, you know, we've gotten a couple of feet of snow over Christmas and enough to go cross country skiing at our local golf course. And we have a local ski hill. And so, you know, we would take the kids up there every week. So we do, we're at 7,500 feet elevation. So, up against the mountains. Yeah. So we do get some snow. Nice.
Yeah, we haven't. So outside of Chicago, I didn't even really realize this until yesterday. Someone reminded me or mentioned it that we haven't had any snow yet this year, which is pretty rare. So, and we don't have any in the forecast for Christmas. So a little sad, but it is what it is. I'm okay with it. I've come to terms. But anyway, though, that's actually a good segue to talk more about the meat of I know what we were itching to talk about, because, you know, you think about it. So, okay, here we are in this deconstruction space, for lack of other term, and talking about going to church on Christmas or Christmas Eve, and, you know, what is the emphasis of that Christmas message, the Christmas story, right, is the birth of Jesus and the significance of that to everything that is the essence of Christianity. And so, you know, that brings us to that question of, well, who is Jesus to us now, right? What does Jesus mean to us now in this space where we no longer connect with, hold the same kind of beliefs with Christianity? And I know we talked about potentially thinking back to how we've viewed him historically, right? How our understanding of Jesus has evolved. So, yeah, so I'll kick it over to you. What do you think? What is, how have you noticed your understanding, or who he is to you? How has that evolved?
So when I first started, or like dropped my religious beliefs, my friend had said, you know, don't let go of Jesus. Like, there's something special about Jesus. And I trusted, I really trust my friend, Robert Pelfrey. He's always been like a spiritual mentor to me. So I trusted him, and I thought, okay, you know, how can I do this spiritual thing, keeping Jesus, but letting go of everything else? Like, how would that even work? And my first, you know, at that time I had started looking into the Christian mysticism and kind of going back to the beginning of like, well, who did they think that Jesus was? Like, who did these early believers think, like, what did they think about him? And so I kind of was doing the Christian mysticism thing, and Thomas Merton, you know, he's considered a more modern Christian mystic. So I was reading some of him, and I was reading, I stumbled across Henry Nouwen, because it's kind of like those guys all seem to go together. Mm-hmm. Henry Nouwen also is Catholic. And so I kind of went down this path a little bit of like a Catholic perspective on Jesus and this like more mystical version of Jesus. And then the Thomas Merton book, well, I guess let me back up. There were definitely times when it felt like Jesus was starting to naturally fall away. Like, the more that I went into the self-inquiry part of things, the deeper that I went into shedding my beliefs, shedding my identities, Jesus and that issue just sort of started to fade into the background a little bit. And then it would pop up again, like in this book, The New Man by Thomas Merton. A friend of mine gave me this book, and he presented just what felt to me like a really radical thing of Jesus. And basically that was saying that Jesus represented what we all are, that we are all divine, that we are all part human, part divine, you know, part God, part man, And that in that sense, Jesus was special because he showed us what we really were, but not special in the sense that he was saying we all were what he was. And I remember there was a part in The New Man where my brain just lit up like, oh my God, like we are all little, like literally little Christs running around in the sense of we are a temple. We are each where God meets earth. It was just this reality of like, oh my God, I am the same thing that Jesus was. There is nothing that Jesus is or has that I couldn't have, that I don't already have. And so at that point, I mean, because Merton doesn't necessarily come out and say it that I can remember, but it definitely fed this idea that you are God. I am God in the same sense that Jesus was God. And that, what was nice is that it lined up with some of the self-inquiry and like other mystical stuff that I was seeing and reading about, that the deeper that you go into yourself, sort of the more that you empty yourself, that's where God can meet you. And it's like, well, that makes sense then, that the more identities that I shed and the more that I let go of, if God is there, like at the bottom of it all, then that's what I've been this whole time. And not saying that I'm God, like I'm omniscient and I'm omnipotent and all those like majestic, all those big words that we throw out, but that there is some ineffable quality that is divine, that is inside of me, just like it was inside of Jesus. That just kind of blew my mind.
And so that was really your, well, just to be clear, that was your foray into this shedding of some of the dogmas and doctrines about Jesus and about the Christian faith in general, while still not letting go, as your mentor encouraged you, right, to not let go of Jesus. This is the space that you landed in. Am I following right?
Yeah, that's actually a really good way to put it, because at the beginning of my deconstruction, I let go of all of my ideas about God and the Bible. Mm-hmm. But then I had been encouraged to hold on to Jesus and to investigate that more. But in doing that investigation, reading these different theories and ideas about Jesus, that's a really good way to put mm-hmm. it. I was sort of like deconstructing the beliefs that I'd had around who Jesus was and mm-hmm. what he represented and, you know, what his death and resurrection meant and that sort of thing. So yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And then would you say that is a, I guess, how long did you hold on to that understanding? Or would you say that you're still there now?
So I guess I had this idea. I got this idea from Merton that basically that we had to go back through ourselves to get to God. Almost, I mean, I guess in a way you could almost say that would be like what the crucifixion was. Jesus, like going through his humanity in order to get back to God in a way. But Merton had given me this idea that the only way like to keep through this spiritual path or whatever was to go through myself, and that what I would find essentially is this divine essence. And so after I read Merton, that felt like it gave me the permission to go as deep inside of myself as I could possibly go. And so, and again, at that point, it started to feel like the important thing about Jesus as being represented by Merton wasn't so much this, you know, evangelical belief in him and in his name and yada, yada, yada. It wasn't that Jesus was necessarily the way to God, but that Jesus represented how to do it, how to be it. And so, you know, Jesus was willing to shed all of his identities to the point of death, like his human self, right? To the point of death. And for me, what that would look like is just to keep letting go and dropping as many identities as I possibly could, as many beliefs as I possibly could, just to continue this process of emptying myself completely. And so again, I guess from that book, it just, I lost Jesus as the focal point. I didn't lose him as a representative of what I was doing, but it totally shifted my perspective to like, oh, I'm not following Jesus. You know, I can let go of all of those evangelical beliefs and see Jesus as the person who emptied himself so completely that he was able to have a fuller experience of God and himself as divine. That's what I need to do. Like, maybe that's what it means to follow Jesus, is to really be willing to let go of everything that I think I know, of everything that I think is true. And so I had done this unknowing of God at the beginning of my deconstruction experience, letting go of everything that I thought I knew to be true about God. And then kind of like you, what you said, I was also now letting go of everything that I thought to be true about Jesus. And my next step felt like letting go of everything I thought to be true about myself, and those, just emptying myself of my judgments and my ideas and my concepts of what it was to be this person called Karen, this human being.
Yeah, it's like you're really being a, to put it into evangelical terms, which is where we're coming from, right? You are where we came from. You are being a true disciple of Jesus in that respect, right? It's almost like the being a disciple of Jesus tends to feel like, in the church, someone who behaves well, serves Jesus, and all these things, but it less often comes across as someone like genuinely like following in the footsteps, picking up their cross and following him. But that's what I'm hearing in what you're saying, is, you know, and not even that's an important thing for you to be able to put it in that language anymore. Maybe not, but it's just interesting to hear that, like, for you to follow into that, like, letting go of yourself that Jesus talks about so much, it was through walking away from all the other stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you bring that up. This week, as I was thinking about this question of who is Jesus to me now, and I had this sensation, like, I had to sort of restrain myself from going and spewing this out there on the internet somewhere, because I couldn't discern what the energy was behind it. But I had this, I don't know, like anger or something inside of me, because I was thinking about how sometimes people can get so precious with their faith. And I was definitely one of them, of talking softly and just, oh, I just love Jesus. And, you know, keeping my Bible all nice and neat, and having this idea that your faith is just this really precious thing that you have to treat so gently. And I had this sensation that we treat some of the Bible stories or some of the parables that Jesus says that way. Like there's the parable, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but whatever, about our faith, or about the kingdom of heaven is what, like a treasure that's buried in a field. And the guy goes and he sells everything that he has to buy this field, or the pearl of great price, you know, that giving up everything that you own for this one thing. And Jesus telling disciples, you know, telling his disciples, leave your nets and come follow me. And we sort of romanticize it. We're like, oh, my faith is just this beautiful treasure in a field, and the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure in a field. And I was just overwhelmed with this rawness. Like, my experience has been that you have to let go of everything, like just as much as you possibly can in order to get that. Like, you know, I thought about me and my husband, like if we walked away from our house, from our job, from his 401k, from all of our friends, all of our town, to go and like sold everything that we owned and told people we bought a field, people be like, what? Like, you're crazy. Like, you left everything to go buy a field? And just, I was listening to King of Country sing like the Drummer Boy song, and it's so good. And this is like really like epic, kind of loud, powerful anthem type of a song. But I loved it because it was so raw. It was like, that's the kind of raw energy that I want to have of pursuing this spirituality, like pursuing this deep part of me. I mean, I want to go, I think I even told you, I was like, I want to go like balls to the walls for it. Like, are you really seeking? And I guess that was the thing that I was thinking about, like with how precious we can hold our faith. It's like, are you even really seeking? Like, are you even really like willing to let go of all the things that you think you believe are true? If it took letting go of your belief in God, or letting go in of your faith in Jesus, or letting go of your belief in the Bible to get the salvation that you want, would you really do it? And it was all around this, I don't know. And so I do think in a way, like now Jesus really doesn't play that big of a role in my journey anymore. I don't feel like I need him, but he feels now like a friend that I see from afar, and I wave at him. I'm like, yeah, I see you over there, Jesus. Like, I get it now. I'm on the path. We're on the path together. Like, I'm on the path. And it feels more like that, and not like someone I'm following behind like a puppy. Like, tell me what to do, Jesus. Tell me what to do. Kind of, I don't know. He feels more like a friend that I wave at from afar as he pops up here and there in different things. Yeah.
Yeah. That it goes into something that's arising for me, is this thought of like all the different roles that Jesus can play. One of them that it just, I don't know, for some reason it's arising is King, right? I mean, Jesus is King, and you know, that's how he's so often portrayed in the church, is he is this king, this lord over our lives, and we are to worship him. So thinking back to like to my evolution into where I am today, as I've talked about before, I wasn't really practicing any sort of Christian faith for most of my early 20s, early to mid 20s. And but there was always like something in the back of my mind of like still having some subconscious belief in that Jesus, that like king type of Jesus. And then through spiritual experiences, I went back to the evangelical church, but something interesting started to happen even back then, where I would just notice when people would talk about Jesus, it always felt awkward to me. I could like almost sense awkwardness in other people. And it got me starting to think like, I think there's a lot of people that just really aren't sure about who Jesus is, or they don't have a strength of faith in it because he is this character in, you know, arguably the most significant story in history, but, and that, that no, there's no disputing that, of course, but like, is it literally true? Did all right. of it literally happen? Is what mm-hmm. is what the mainstream predominant view of Jesus literally true? And I just, for some reason, even though I had like just really gotten more involved in the church, that piece of it, it really right away started to like, I'd always had this belief in God, but I'm like, but is Jesus God? So it's interesting that move from that view of, you know, following Jesus in terms of like hearing his calling and his leading and his voice. And for me, it was more programmed into me that he was this king and savior that we were supposed to bow down and worship. So yeah, but it was interesting to see how that even as I got more involved in the Christian faith, it was very subtly unwinding that was just something of Jesus that didn't really resonate. And I had this view of even if I believe that he was literally a person who did all the things, all of it's accurate, it's not fiction. Even if all that were true, I was like, you know what? I just don't think that this type of character would be the one that wants to be worshipped as a central point of a religion.
Mm-hmm.
That started mm-hmm. to unravel for me to think that way. Really, but I would say before I even had any sense that I was deconstructing, because for me, deconstruction was more the big theological things of heaven and hell and the you're in or you're out kind of thing that was really set me off. But yeah, so that was where I would say that was where I was before I started to deconstruct. And that's where I see a lot of even call it mainstream Christianity today is that, you know, full like exclusive deification that like Jesus is this God figure that, you know, we are to treat accordingly rather than, as you're saying, equals. It's this view of, yeah, him as a pure deity and no equality with us.
Mm-hmm. When I was, I guess it must have been last summer, I had stumbled upon this book at like a local coffee shop. It was Chinese fairy tales. And I saw it and I thought, oh my gosh, that would be just a great book to read with the boys and as part of our homeschool. And so I picked it up and I brought it home and I decided to introduce it into our homeschool routine. And so, you know, I'm going through my deconstruction and all these different things on the inside, right? And then outside, I'm still trying to homeschool my kids and stuff. So we start reading these Chinese fairy tales and I start to notice this theme where pretty much every single story starts with a god coming down to earth in the form of a monk or a beggar. And he comes into the community and he sort of tests people's kindness. You know, he's dressed all like a beggar and asking people for hospitality or to give him food or something. And the people who do what he asks, who help him, get blessed. And then the ones that don't help him get cursed. And so just like the repetitive nature of this theme, I started to think like, that sounds an awful lot like Christianity, that you have God coming to earth in the form of a baby, you know, in the family of a carpenter, born in a stable, very humble beginnings. And the story of the life is that he comes into the community and it's sort of testing how well are people following the commandments, right? Like how well are people doing what God is wanting them to do? And so then just the kid, you know, because the kids really liked the mythology, the fairy tale aspect of this, we started reading other stuff. We started reading folk tales from indigenous peoples, and we started reading folk tales from Africa, and we started reading the Greek myths. And again, I just started noticing, for example, there is a Greek myth that is a story about like the gods making it rain and this particular man getting a message from a god that he needs to build a boat. And so he builds a boat and his family survives. I mean, it is, you can't read it and not think of Noah's Ark. And so it started making me wonder how many other things in the Bible could potentially be based off of other mythological stories from the other people groups that, you know, the ancient Bible people were around, and how would that be influenced? And we read this indigenous people story about the creation of humans. And it was this idea that God came and the Great Spirit came and gave some instructions. And then 12 moons later, he was going to return. And then this beaver was going to be cut up into 12 different pieces. So I'm like, the number 12, like there were 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples. Like, and so anyway, all of this to say that there's a lot of things in scripture that appear to be borrowed, heavily influenced by other myths and fairy tales from the surrounding cultures. And so I started kind of even beginning to look at Jesus, like you said, not even so much as potentially a literal figure, but even this mythological representation. And my brother even told me today that apparently in some circles, people think that Jesus was just a new version of the Greek god Dionysus, who is known as the god of wine. So I think it's interesting because, yeah, you're right. Like, there is this deity aspect of Jesus. And I kind of wonder, was that borrowed from the myths? Did they emphasize that? And I 100% agree with you. Like, I don't think, I mean, Jesus nowhere said, worship me, make me the center of everything. Like, he was always pointing at something else. He never pointed to himself. But yet the Christian, you know, the Christian religion has changed it to make Jesus the human the focal point of everything.
Yeah. And I'm being like, on the regarding of the mythological underpinnings and the question of it is, are the gospel accounts historically accurate? And I think the consensus is that we just don't know, right? And mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a debate I had, an online, I think it was Facebook comment debate, which we all know how those can go. but I for some reason it's burned into my memory. This was probably almost 2 years ago now, talking about the events of Jesus's life and the significance of it. And I remember saying something to the effect that, like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't yes. matter if it's historically accurate or not, because mm-hmm. it has had a huge impact regardless. So whether mm-hmm. it actually happened, whether Jesus was actually a person, is a moot point, really. And I mean, a lot of people are going to freak out if you allow yourself to go there. But the real, and that's something that I've gone to, is the reality is I don't know, right? I have no, unless I can build a time machine, I have no way of knowing. And but then yet, what remains, right? It's kind of that. I think it's one of the values of allowing the deconstruction of parts of our beliefs works, right? Is we let those things go, and then it's like, okay, well, what's there now? You know, what remains? And that's what I found is, like, well, okay, so let's just, for sake of analysis here, let's say it didn't happen, that Jesus was completely made up person, yet here we are 2,000 years later, and there's literally billions of Christians, like perhaps the most influential name in the history of the world. It's kind of neat. It's been neat for me to still find that significance, even if it's all fiction. You know, it's like you said, like all the other mythological tales out there, it could be, at the end of the day, it could be no different. Just obviously a lot more significant to the Western world, at least.
Right. It's funny because I hear it from so many people. There are so many people who continue to hold on to Jesus. And to be honest, I don't think I would have had it not been for Robert saying, you know, keep looking at Jesus. Like there's something there. And I'm not even sure if the place where I've landed now is where maybe Robert was intending to send me. Not that it matters, but I see so many people in the deconstruction space. And I have, you know, I have a couple of good friends who are saying that they just keep holding on to Jesus, but they don't know what to, you know, to do about it or whatever. They're still holding on. And to be honest, like even now I kind of wonder why. I don't know if that is driven by fear or really a genuine love for the story of Jesus. And not that there's anything wrong with it. I mean, keep Jesus if you want, get rid of Jesus completely. Jesus is definitely not necessary for a spirituality, right? I mean, that's incredibly prideful and ethnocentric, I guess, maybe to say that Jesus is necessary for spirituality. So can toss Jesus out completely. And I think it does take something away because of his place in history, this, you know, everything that has gone on in his name. But yeah, I kind of wonder, like, what, whenever people say, oh, there's just something about Jesus, part of me wonders, is that because you're afraid to let go of him as a security blanket kind of a thing? Or I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody who's been able to articulate well why they want to continue holding on to him. But I think it is interesting that, you know, we can let go of the Bible, we can let go about beliefs about God, but there is something intriguing about Jesus that seems to set him apart so that he can stand alone in the Gospels without the rest of everything else.
Yeah, and maybe a course change here, but something that I'm thinking of with that idea of hanging on to Jesus, you know, I think there is the fear there, definitely. Like, there's so much fear in all of this, right? Fear of making the wrong choice, like probably some lingering fear of if you walk away from Jesus, you're not going to go to heaven when you die, like stuff like that is, you know, I can say that kind of stuff personally without any inner resistance now, thankfully, but it definitely lingered for a while. But I've been intrigued to interact with some individuals who I know to be very, I'll call them spiritually advanced. They, you know, they've moved beyond the literal framing, the, you know, looking at the Bible as a very allegorical tale that provides meaning and value to life, right? But yet there is still that like adoration of Jesus, and here's I think the place where it gets a little weird, but interestingly weird, is the spiritual dimension of all this stuff. Because these individuals that I'm thinking of that I know and have either had conversations with or I've heard them speak about it, they have had real encounters with Jesus in like a spiritual way. Like they have met the person of Jesus. And so there's I think we could get into like the psychology of that, you know, what goes on inside your brain. Not that either of us are anywhere near experts in that, but you know, it's like there's an interesting element where we can really, yeah, we can let go of all of the doctrines and the biblical inerrancy and literalism. And yet there's still this, like, I'll call it worship and adoration of the character of Jesus. And people see him as like, a spirit guide is the word that comes to mind. And I have been envious of that because I'm not there. I mean, I guess to fast forward, where I'm at today is, I see Jesus as more, I see Jesus more objectively, you know, like, oh, I understand exactly like the significance of the story, kind of like we've talked about. But for me personally, I'm drawn to the themes of surrender and everything that he stood for. I'm drawn to that, as I think we all should be, frankly. But does the actual like person of Jesus, whether it's a spiritual being or what have you, there isn't really that significance. And that's where it's interesting. Like, I've had envy for people. I'm like, I kind of would like to have that, right? I'd like to have Jesus come meet me in a dream and say, hey, Dave, just want to let you know that I got your back. Like, I'm gonna help you through whatever it is. You know what I mean? But I haven't had that experience. So it's interesting, like the different dynamics of people, like kind of operating on blind faith of their like putting their faith and hope and trust in Jesus. And then there's these other people who like have very real experiences and they kind of have communion with Jesus in a way that, again, like I said, is very real to them.
You know, so because of all my Christian, you know, my evangelical baggage and stuff, I never really had ventured out to see what other people were doing with their religions or with their, you know, religious teachers or anything like that. But since coming into this consciousness world with Spira and Toll and all those guys, it's interesting to see. So, I mean, as you know, but in most of these settings, whenever you watch a video of Rupert Spira or Eckhart Tolle or Muji or Maharaj or Ramana Maharshi, you know, very much this this like Eastern consciousness philosophy stuff. Yeah, philosophy. You tend to have the guru, right? Like the guy sitting up there or the woman, and people come and they ask questions, and then the guru responds. And I hear these people ask these questions and they'll say, oh, you know, Muji, I've been following you for 10 years and I've listened to all your teachings and I'm trying really hard to do what you tell me to do. And then I read in the book, I Am That with Nisargadatta Maharaj, and Nisargadatta Maharaj will say, I came to this place of consciousness by doing what my teacher told me to do. All I did is I did exactly what my teacher told me to do. And if you trust your teacher and do what they tell you to do, then you will attain this higher, you know, this higher level of being. And it was interesting to me to see that and to think of that in terms of Jesus, like Jesus being there and people coming to Jesus and being like, if I just do what Jesus tells me to do, then I can achieve this higher relationship with God. And just kind of thinking of that interaction. And in that same vein, it made me realize and start thinking about Jesus as more of a guru. Like you said, not that who it is even, like not that the historical person even matters so much, but just seeing him as this guru, as a source of wisdom that you can learn from. I feel like I've left him behind as my guru. Like he was my guru for a while, but I totally didn't get it. And now I'm learning from other gurus. I can look back and I'd be like, oh, I wonder if that's what Jesus was trying to say, you know, but I'm getting it from this other, these other teachers. So I think that that's a different way of thinking about Jesus too, as him being a guru.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing as just reflecting on, well, who do I say Jesus is? And I absolutely, I mean, he is perhaps the most significant guru in all of history, but in ways that is very non-traditional in guru speak. If we were to define guru, if I'm to off the cuff offer up my definition, I'll say that way because this is probably not exactly accurate, but you know, it is a teacher who guides the disciple, the student, to a path of awakening. Mm-hmm. And we'll use the word awakening, which it would not be used in Christianese, right. Really, but really that's it. And actually, I saw a video recently about how Jesus was a non-dual teacher and that he was leading people to awakening. Mm-hmm. So there is a very like Eastern philosophical, spiritual philosophy interpretation that can be had of the character of Jesus as being that. So yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that. And all the times when, you know, the disciples in the gospel accounts would say, like, they don't understand what Jesus is trying mm-hmm. to say. They don't understand. And how often does that happen with these more modern gurus,
yes. right?
Where people just don't quite get it. But I guess that begs the question of, do we need, and maybe we're going off topic, but that's okay. Do we need a guru?
Mm-hmm. So one thing I want to, before we go there, let me pop back. Cause I think that it needs to be said that there were so many things that Jesus said and that have their roots, almost like have to have their roots in Buddhism. And I say that, like, I've read a couple of books by Buddhist teachers, and they will often refer to stories, to parables that Buddha is rumored to have said, or other Buddhist leaders of the past have said, and they are almost word for word the same things that Jesus had said. Like, there's a parable that is credited to Buddha about a man going out and inviting people to a banquet. And it's like, sounds an awful lot like the story of Jesus, you know, saying the kingdom of heaven is like a man who goes out and invites people to a wedding feast. And then there's also something that I had learned is that in Eastern practices, like in Buddhist monasteries, the head monk, the head monk guy will often have a room of disciples, and he will leave them with what they call a koan, K-O-A-N. And what it is intended, a koan, yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. So what it is intended to be is it is intended to be like an unanswerable question, and a question that you're just supposed to sit with and let it penetrate the depths of your being. And that, you know, some disciples would sit with a koan for months, maybe before the head monk would give them another one. And so if you look at some of the questions that Jesus would ask, they're very similar to these Buddhist koans, and not meant to have an answer, just meant to be that thing that you sit with and you wrestle with until you can find even just like a piece around the not knowing. I mean, I'm not entirely sure like what, you know, the head monk or whatever would be looking for. I think it's just important to note that whenever we say that Jesus, you know, is perhaps the most influential guru out there, that just like every other guru, his teachings were influenced and, you know, borrowed from other great past gurus and built upon, you know, by his own experiences, just like the same way that these gurus that we're talking about today, like modern day gurus, will go back and will have an altar, or will continually reference their teachers, but they're like improving upon their teachings every time. But yeah, I do like your question of do we need a guru? And yeah, going there, that's an interesting little twist.
And let me just say one thing, because yeah, so to speak to Jesus's parables and Zen koan And there's probably some other things, but I think this raises a really good point to make for our listeners maybe unfamiliar with this. And I will say that I'm sure I've said it on the podcast before, and I'm sure I will say it again, but the book that I can't recommend enough is The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And the two main references in that book are Jesus and Buddha. Over and over, he references their teachings, and what he extracts from their teachings, and it's Zen koans, it's Jesus's paradoxical parables, things like that, it's about getting outside of our minds more and more and more. And how Tolle would say it is what Jesus is pointing to and what Buddha is pointing to, Jesus maybe more indirectly, Buddha much more directly, is that peace is found when the mind is still, and the mind becomes still through those koans and parables that can't be understood, right? It's like you have to break mm-hmm. your brain mm-hmm. a little bit in order to find that. Yeah. Yeah. And I just think we could have a huge long topic about that, because the mind brain, I'll use those synonymously, it's such a powerful tool, but it's almost like a tool that has like taken over our existence. and that's what these teachers are pointing us to, is like very subtle ways, but trying to like infiltrate into the depths of the mind to get it to find a place of surrender a little bit and just be more embodied and pure. And that's consciousness too, right? Like consciousness is something that is beyond the mind. So anyway, I think, yeah, when you bring up koans and just the overlapping of these spiritual kind of gurus' guidance, I think that's an important element that I have gleaned from what I've learned.
Yeah, I don't. If you look at all of the gurus, the modern gurus that you and I have been referring back to, one of their core messages is that you are your own guru. Like you are your best guru. Your inner being is your best guru. And there's a sense too that they'll say, don't look at my experience. Like, don't take what I say as truth. You have to experience it for yourself. Like, don't just parrot back the words that I've said to you. You have to experience it and know it for yourself. I appreciate that. But at the same time, I can certainly understand how it could be really helpful to have a guru to kind of get you started, you know, or help you along the way. Or even I think for me, the benefit of a guru is similar to what I get from our conversations, is someone to talk to who is in the same mind realm that you are, like has read the same books, has heard the same theories, and can talk to you, not even so much from a teacher perspective, but almost like a peer. Like, maybe like someone who's just a little bit further down the path than you, who can look and say, yeah, I know exactly where you are. I have been there too. And this was my experience of how I got out of it. Or these other guys, sometimes they're actually talking from the perspective of consciousness and just continually reassuring you and pointing you back to your true nature, right? That's the benefit of the guru. But at the same time, just realizing and deeply, deeply recognizing that we have the Holy Spirit inside of us, right? to bring it full circle, that we do have some sort of a deep knowledge inside of us that, like you say, our minds have overrun and it's much harder to tap into. And so really all the guru was doing is pointing you back to that place and trying to give you different ways of tapping into it.
That's reminding me of something I was going to mention earlier, going back to the Jesus evolution of my perception of him. I remember probably in the first year of my deconstruction, I had let go, got to a place similar to where I'm at now. Like, yeah, he's a good guide. Would be neat to have a spiritual experience with him, but at the same time, I'm fine. You know, I'll figure out my path. I'll get there, even though there's nowhere to get, but whatever. I digress. But I had this, I'm a pretty volatile seeker. I've settled probably more lately, but I've like bounced around a lot. Like, oh, this is a better way to say it. Not so much volatile, maybe ADD, ADHD, where like I get really excited about one thing and then I'm like, nah, I move on. Well, the thing I was really excited about for a little while, this was probably a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, was this idea of like, it is just wired into our psyche that we just need a character to represent God to us. I sat with that for a little while, and it made sense, and it didn't stick, obviously. But I do wonder about that, and you know, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on it too, because that does seem to be it, that all the traditions have this. And let me say that differently, not all the traditions, but so many people in the traditions, it's so important for them to have not only this guru, but this guru that they are, the devotion, right? They are devoted to this guru. So an influential figure for me is Ram Dass, really great spiritual teacher, and just offers up a lot of different perspectives and very open to all the different paths, as you know. But he's so devoted to Maharaji, right? Mm-hmm. Like, weirdly mm-hmm. devoted. I'm like, I love so much of what Ram Dass has to say, but every time he talks about his Maharaji stuff, I'm like, I'm less interested. But he was so devoted. This really smart, accomplished, learned, very adept spiritual man was so into him. And that goes, you've got the Christian mystics, you've got a lot of these people that are just so devoted to their guru. And it just has me wondering, like, yeah, it doesn't really resonate for me, but there must be something within human psychology that just almost needs that devotion, needs to be devoted to something in order to feel connected to God, maybe connected to transcendence, if we were being more broad in the application here. Because for example, Buddhism, I don't think Buddhism has strong views one way or another, but there's plenty of Buddhists who wouldn't believe in a quote God, right? They believe, they're devoted to Buddha, but not necessarily presuming that Buddha is God or that Buddha is a gateway to God.
There are a couple of things coming to mind. One is that the devotion does seem sort of strange because it emphasizes the separate self, right? It emphasizes the more that I love God and I'm devoted to God, the more that it emphasizes that there's a separation between us. Mm-hmm. And I thought the same thing whenever I see these modern gurus, like, you know, doing their talks and having their altar to their previous guru right there next to them. And I think but they're just like a representation of consciousness according to your own teachings. So,
right.
Like, yeah. Why are you so devoted to the memory of them when but your teachings kind of indicated the past doesn't really matter. And it's now, you know, that there does seem to be a strange disconnect or conflict there with that treatment. The other thing I'm thinking of is, I mean, there could be cultural things at play potentially that we're just not privy to from a Western perspective. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was for a long time, there was this idea that, and maybe there still is, that, you know, your guru could lay hands on you and transmit power, mm-hmm. or that your guru could speak a word over you and give you a blessing that would have some sort of tangible effect in your life. I wonder if there's anything to that, of that devotion, that the devotion is a way of earning continued favor. I don't know. I mean, and then I think about Jesus for me, like what he was for me, what he represented for me, and just this loving figure who was as devoted to me as I was to him, that his love for me knew no bounds, right? Like, what can separate us from the love of God, from the love of Jesus? And that, you know, we love him because he first loved us, that this devotion is a response to the love that we feel from our guru. I don't know. Cause now I feel very, yeah, now it's hard for me. Also, it's hard for me to imagine being that in love or being that devoted to someone. I mean, you're right that it does seem to be some sort of a need inside of us. It may be an insecurity in our own self, right? It's just indicative that we're not quite ready to trust ourselves. But then, I mean, that doesn't necessarily explain, you know, Ram Dass and all those guys and the way they talk about their gurus is so. And that raises another thing that I thought was interesting, is that some of the modern gurus will talk about how your relationship with a guru should be very short, that it should be very short and very intense. And then you move on. Like, you glean what you can from the relationship and then you go. And that if you're lingering somewhere and hanging around a guru for decades and decades, either you're not listening or it's not the right relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I almost wonder if, now I'm going to get way outside the box, so be warned, but
go ahead.
I almost wonder if you're potentially on both sides of the illusion there is devotion to a deity, and people like us are just kind of like floating around, whatever. And maybe a guru, or a deity, but we're focusing on guru, on both sides of the illusion. And maybe it helps to keep people grounded, or the feeling of being grounded. And let me go back to what I mean by both sides of the illusion is, as you said, these really Eastern philosophy, probably non-dual leaning, if not absolute non-dual, are teaching a philosophy that we are all one. We are a game of sorts unfolding in this reality, right?
Right, and there's no separation. So,
right,
yeah. Just by non-dual, we mean there's no separation. Everything is all one. Yeah.
It's all one. It's all one big thing. One experience that is unfolding from one source. Is that's how I understand it better. Anyway, and so I wonder if there are those that are on, call it, the other side of the illusion, the other side of the veil, to use gospel speak. And they realize the non-dual, the oneness of all things, and yet they still opt to be devoted to a guru for whatever reason. You know what I mean? Like, that's where we're going into paradox here. This is a Zen koan that we're figuring out. Like, why are there these individuals, so many highly respected, that have realized this non-dual, this oneness, and yet are still fully invested into the separateness of our being, you know, the power dynamic, right? And that's the odd thing, right? Like, a non-dual perspective would say we are all one in the same, and yet we're buying into this power dynamic that the guru is my, has a power over me.
There's definitely a comfort in that, right? Again, that comfort of having someone who is responsible in a way, like, it sort of shifts the responsibility. And for me, having come out of Christianity and finding these teachings that I am my own guru, and that it's getting to the deepest part of myself is the thing that I am seeking, right? That like what I am seeking is the same thing that is seeking me, you know, that saying. That was really comforting from having come out of Christianity, when I'd gotten to a place in my faith where I was thinking, where I had been starting to feel for a while that I could no longer trust a God who didn't seem to be watching out for me like I had always imagined and been told that he was. And so, you know, I don't know if maybe, you know, from an Eastern perspective, if there, you know, there's maybe the opposite sense of you are looking, you know, you're the only one looking out for yourself. And then you find a guru and you're able to believe that this guru has your best interests at heart. And this guru can give you a blessing and will speak a blessing over you, if maybe that is the comfort, and almost like a father parent figure, right? That better than a parent figure. I mean, that's what God and Jesus were supposed to be, right? Better than your earthly fathers. This heavenly father is like better than your earthly father. And so there's a comfort there. And definitely if you have that comfort, I mean, I can imagine why people would be devoted. But I know for me, it was the opposite, just being given the freedom. I mean, it took me a little while to feel like it was necessarily a good thing. But when I got there, recognizing that I am my own inner guru and that I can find that same divinity inside of myself, and I didn't need anybody else to do it for me. Granted, I have certainly gotten so much from the teachers that I have been exposed to. It wasn't like all just dreamt up on my own. Knowing that I didn't need anybody else to help me get to that place, that it was possible for me to do it without a Jesus figure, felt really powerful after a while.
Yeah. And what this is making me think of is I think without a doubt, the biggest catalyst for this Christian evangelical deconstruction movement and other religious faith traditions are having similar things happening. It's the internet, right? The availability. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are connecting over the internet, right? It's nice to be able to find people that have similar philosophical views, but it oftentimes takes the internet. I'm not going to meet people in my day-to-day life. I'm not going to be able to go to a local church and find someone that speaks the same as you. It's harder. And same applies for teachers, right? I mean, we have such a wealth. And so it's interesting. It's almost like the yin and yang, the good and the bad of this I'm seeing, is that we don't have the luxury of having that one wise teacher to put all of our eggs into their basket, you know, have that two-way feedback, mm-hmm. to say what do I need to do, and they give their wisdom. Like, I don't know about you, but I don't have someone to go per se. I don't have someone to go to me with that level of authority in my life and ask them like, what do I need to do, and then I just do it, mm-hmm. right? Kind of like you said with Nisargadatta, right? And I think that's a really cool story. So that's kind of the downside, right, of being in this internet age where we're less likely to have that. But the upside is we have this wealth of knowledge, and we are so much less limited, right? So all this seeking for this one path guru throughout history, I wonder if it might fizzle, right? Because it can be so limiting to appeal to individuals. Like you said, I mean, people could bounce around from guru to guru to guru and probably waste a lot of time, because maybe that person just isn't for them. But in the modern age, it's like, well, let me find a teaching that connects. Oh, not this one, not this one. Oh, this person. Really? Mm-hmm. I get what they're saying. So it's interesting. There's kind of that, I guess, like so many things, there's two sides to all coins. I really, for some reason, I'm really seeing that two sides to this clearly right now.
Just as you were talking, my mind was going in a kind of a different direction, but I was thinking about back to the people who are, you know, who are still holding on to Jesus, and how perhaps one of the key things about Jesus is that he is a very prominent figure, teacher, representative to hold on to in this chaotic time of social justice and just political chaos and quarantine, because he does embody loving others and watching out for the poor, mm-hmm. and the, you know, and the oppressed. And he's a really, it's like the people who believe in him can be very controversial, but when you get down at just the core teachings of Jesus, that's very clear that you watch out for the widows and the poor and, you know, the orphans, that you help the oppressed, that you align yourself with the people who are oppressed. And it's a lot easier to cling to him and to be able to see yourself as a good person by holding on to Jesus than being able to, you know, leave that affiliation. I was just thinking about that, as especially in the time that we're in now, he's the very central figure that you can be like, well, I don't know about this social justice movement, and I don't know about this going on, and I don't know about Trump or Biden or whatever, but I'm going to align myself with the teachings of Jesus. It's like a safe place to land.
Well, and it fills that natural desire and need to feel like a good person. Right.
And I mean, we all want to hold on to. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We all want to be good people. And so it's interesting. It's a crutch. It could be a crutch.
It could be.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To say, well, I'm an asshole. I don't treat people well. I'm unfaithful or whatever. A lot of these bad things, but I follow Jesus, you know, and like, oh man, that is the ultimate, yeah, crutch in that relationship. So, you know, to go back to the topic here, like Jesus could be a crutch, right? For our own actual like work. And that's actually been one of my big gripes moving away from the mainstream view, is like, I do think he has a tendency to be a crutch, because it's like, well, Jesus died for my sins. That's it. Jesus settles it. And there's this less emphasis on like inner work, right? The inner work that we need to do. And that's not to say, I know that there's a lot of Christians out there who see Jesus as their Lord and Savior and still do the inner work. But I think it's so easy to use him as a crutch and just wait on the prize after life that Jesus bought for you, and not really focus on finding it now.
I think the flip side of that too is that, kind of like what we've talked about in previous episodes, is when you go through this, you know, when you let go of your religious beliefs and you feel yourself kind of, you know, sliding down this slippery slope, this, you know, icy luge where there's nothing to hold on to, where when you're in the reef and all of your, you know, all of your reefs are breaking down or being chipped apart and you're feeling very vulnerable, Jesus is a safe thing to grab onto. It's like, you know, and I think that that's even probably what my friend Robert was indicating to me, that like, when you feel like there's nothing left for you to hold on to, you can still hold on to Jesus. And I guess now I would say, because he is a teacher of this like non-dual path, like there is more to him than what we were taught and understood. But then even at some, and I think like how I experienced it, you know, like at some point, in order to continue on, my experience has been that I had to let go of Jesus as well, that at a point, the thing that had got me that far was the very thing that I had to let go of to keep going. And, you know, there's a poem by Shel Silverstein that comes to mind, and it's called The Bridge. And I think it's like the bridge will take you halfway there. The rest you have to go on your own. And it does kind of seem like that to me maybe is what Jesus sort of represents now, is showing you the way, right? Like showing you the way, the letting go, the emptying of yourself completely, even to the point of death, I guess you would say. But at some point you can no longer rely on Jesus to get you there. You have to let go and walk on your own. And kind of like what I was saying earlier about the gurus being like, don't just parrot the words that I say. You have to experience them. If you don't experience them for yourself, they're just empty, meaningless words. And that's like, we can follow the life of Jesus, but until we actually experience what it is to leave everything behind, that's when we really come to know. And again, this could all just be total bullshit. Like, I don't know. This could just like all whatever, right? Like, we're not saying that there is any one right way, but this has been our experience. And I think it's helpful for others to hear that there's more to be had in this journey, right? There's more ways to see your past. There's more ways to understand what is here and now available to us. There's more ways to understand who Jesus is and what he represents. And also that you can let it all go. And there's still something there.
All right. Well, with that excellent Karen sermon, we will we'll wrap it up.
My soapbox sometimes.
No. That's really good. And I think if I could, I'll just add a little color commentary as we wrap up. Yeah, I think for us, for everyone listening out there, you know, it's Christmas time, and it is a good time to reflect. It's a Christmas time, but it's also like, okay, New Year is coming up. And I think it's a good time to ask that question, who is Jesus to me, and how might I see Jesus differently in next year? And honestly, it could mean so many different things. And that's maybe the takeaway here, is it could mean so many different things. But I think it's such a good reflection to be willing to play around with and see this person of Jesus in a different light, and be willing to walk away if that feels okay, or to be willing to walk back if you've walked away. But again, that's the point of transformation that I think Karen and I are both speaking of, is the more that we've been willing to take risks and challenge our previous ways of thinking, it's been helpful. So yeah, everyone listening, I would highly encourage just really meditate on that question and be willing to step into something that might be different and uncomfortable. Thank you for listening, as always, and Merry Christmas. And if we don't talk to you also, Happy New Year.
Yep. Happy holidays, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.